From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. After a devastating motorcycle accident, Hopkins bioethicist Travis Reeder was prescribed high doses of opioids to stave off pain. When he began to taper off the drugs, he was immediately thrown into withdrawal.
It's really terrible. It feels like the worst case of the flu you've ever had, but that's the best that it gets. From there, symptoms dial up, so depression kicks in, and the crying and the depression got worse and worse, and it kind of circled down.
The advice Reeder got from his doctors was to go back on opioids. His medical team had no plan for weaning him from the drugs. Reeder's new book, In Pain, explores the history of opioids, how they became so widely prescribed, why they're so addictive, and how the medical system should be changed. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Whether prescribed for back pain, a broken bone, or after dental surgery, opioids can be found in medicine cabinets across the country. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that doctors in the U.S. wrote 199 million prescriptions for opioids in 2017, which works out to nearly 6 opioid prescriptions for every 10 Americans. And that staggering number is smaller than the one 5 years earlier, when enough opioids were prescribed for every adult in the country to have a bottle of pills. A new book titled In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids, chronicles the agony of withdrawal and sheds light on America's reliance on opioids for pain management, a crutch that has driven drug abuse rates and overdose deaths skyward. Travis Reeder is a research scholar at Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, where he also directs the Master of Bioethics program, and he's the Institute's Assistant Director for Educational Initiatives. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
You and I, we spoke back on the air in 2017 after you wrote an essay about your experience, the germ of this book. Take us back to May 23rd, 2015. What happened?
Oh, not a great day for me. It started off well. I was going to go on a motorcycle ride, which was one of my favorite things to do, but I geared up and got on my bike and said goodbye to my partner and my little daughter, who at the time was about 1.5, and pulled away and didn't make it 3 blocks from my house. A large white van, blew a stop and T-boned me on the motorcycle, crushing my foot and tossing me from the bike.
Crushing your foot. Describe the injuries.
Yeah, it's a little gruesome, but so best we can tell, the foot was either crushed between the bike and the van's bumper, and or when I was tossed to the ground, the bike actually landed on top of the leg. And so the first, second, and third metatarsals, the long bones connecting your first, second, and third toes, were broken, and the first was shattered, just absolutely obliterated, and blew a large hole out the inside and bottom of the foot. So there was a lot of soft tissue damage, a lot of bone shards, and it's considered a mangled extremity. So I was in what's called a limb salvage situation, where they don't know whether they will amputate or reconstruct the limb.
How many surgeries did you need?
All told, I've had 6 so far. We'll probably have another one in the future, but at this point, it's just pain-relieving surgeries. They're all elective from here on out. And the first 5 were considered limb salvage. So it took 5 surgeries to keep the foot alive, to put it back together to where I wasn't in immediate danger of losing the foot. And we did salvage the foot, yeah. And then a 6th surgery came about 6 months later. It was a plastic surgery to make the foot a little bit more foot-shaped.
Oh. And during your recovery, you were prescribed extended release and fast-acting forms of opioids. How effective were they?
At the beginning, they were incredibly effective. And this is a point that I try to make sure I make all the time, because there's a lot of news about how dangerous and scary opioids are. And that news has real effects. It has effects on scaring doctors into not prescribing, has effects in scaring regulators into trying to restrict prescriptions. But trauma patients are one of the kind of paradigm cases of where opioids are just absolutely necessary. Your pain is off the charts. Your limbs have been, you know, mangled or blown apart. And these medications, oxycodone and fentanyl and morphine and hydromorphone, these are all drugs that I took. They make life worth living when you're really in the throes of those that acute agony.
You write about feeling panic start to set in when your meds would start to wear off. You write you were desperate to stay ahead of the pain.
Yeah, so there's this very strange thing that happens, which is when you're in a trauma situation, everybody who comes into your hospital room asks you to rate your pain on a scale of 0 to 10. And so this is called the pain scale. It's taken to be very useful so that patients can kind of give an objective, somewhat objective number to their pain.
Yeah, it never seems objective to me at all.
Really isn't. It's very problematic. And as you saw, there's a chapter in the book on it. But what it does is it allows us to talk about the pain, or at least one dimension of it, which is intensity. And I was very worried about this. I'm trained as a philosopher, so I had these very strange thoughts like, how will I know if I hit a 10 on the pain scale? You know, won't I always be able to imagine it being dialed up? And how can I know that a 10 for me is the same as a 10 to you? So the first night in the hospital, I had my pain very under-medicated. And during the entire experience, this is the only time that I say I hit a 10 on the pain scale. And it was nightmarish. It was horrifying. In the throes of that kind of pain, you think about suicide. You think about how you have to lose consciousness. And having that experience on the first night in the hospital really framed the rest of my pain management experience, because I always was afraid of that. And so I was desperate not to get behind the pain, which is why I thought it happened that first time. And I was always watching the clock, ready to take my next meds.
Once your foot was stabilized, you were sent home. When did you realize that your prescriptions were a problem?
I never did realize it myself. It never once occurred to me. You know, we're about a couple months out from the accident, about a month out from the last surgery. And I was actually feeling very good about myself, because I started to reduce my own pain medication just of my own accord. And it wasn't until a checkup with the trauma surgeon where he asked, what doses are you on? And we kind of did the math and related to him. And he became very serious and said, oh, that's way too much meds, way too heavy a dose for this far out. You need to get off them now.
And at that point, you had been on opioids how long?
About 2 months. And very quickly increasing doses. So the phenomenon of tolerance, that your body becomes accustomed to the dose and you need more to achieve the same level of pain, analgesia. And every couple of weeks, sometimes every week, my dose would be increased. And so I was on fairly high doses at that point.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Hopkins bioethicist Travis Reeder, whose book called In Pain details his own experience becoming dependent on opioids after a painful accident and examines the vast problem of opioid overprescription. So the doctor says that's too much. What happens then?
Well, he said it's too much, but he also said that he wasn't the one in charge of helping me to get off them. And so we said, well, you know, what do we do? And he said, well, who's been managing your prescriptions? We said, the plastic surgeon. He said, okay, so go see a plastic surgeon. He'll give you a taper. He'll tell you how to slowly get off the meds, because you can't just stop them cold turkey. You'll go into withdrawal. And so we did that. We went to see the plastic surgeon. And by contrast to the trauma surgeon, he was very unconcerned, and he said, oh, yeah, if you think you're ready, you can go off the meds now. No. So we said, so how do we do it? And he said, take the dose that you're on, your average daily dose, cut it into four, and drop a quarter each week. And we didn't know any better. We were a little nervous about it, but this isn't our area of expertise. And so we did it, but it turns out that was a very, very aggressive taper and was very bad advice.
It essentially put you into withdrawal.
It immediately put me into withdrawal.
Yeah. What was that like?
It gets worse as it goes on if you're continuing to taper, because the kind of sick joke of tapering opioids is that the severity of the withdrawal is related to the percentage decrease from your last dose. And that means if you divided your starting dose into four equal parts, that first drop is only a quarter, it's 1/4. But then your second drop is a third, right? And your third drop is a half of what you're currently on. And that last drop is everything. And so each of these drops go up in the percentage of the dose that you were on. And so the severity of the withdrawal symptoms get worse as you go. So it started out probably the way people think about it if they've seen depictions of heroin withdrawal on TV or in the movies. It's sweats and goose flesh and nausea and your nose runs and your eyes run. And it's really terrible. It feels like the worst case of the flu you've ever had. But that's the best that it gets. From there, symptoms dial up and you start getting psychological symptoms if you're like me. So depression kicks in. I began crying, and the crying and the depression got worse and worse, and it kind of circled down. Mm. And yeah, I would just let myself sink further and further into depression while I got sicker and sicker.
So while this is going on, where did you turn for help?
First, we turned to our prescribing physicians. So Sadia, my partner, would call the initial prescribing physician. He was spectacularly unhelpful. When she finally got a hold of him, the plastic surgeon, his advice was, well, if it's that bad, he can just go back to his previous dose and, you know, we'll try this all again later. But since he didn't
have
any...
How did that strike you, that advice?
It was insane, because if it was going to be this way next time as well, then why in the world would I throw away the little gains that I'd gotten going through this agony? And so I said, well, look, if you don't have any advice for making it better next time, I'm not doing this again. And so we did keep calling around. We called more than a dozen clinicians who had worked with us at three different hospitals, and most of them wouldn't speak to us. And the ones that would speak to us said, basically, not my problem. And that even included a pain management team at one of the hospitals who had gotten my pain under control, who I had all the love in the world for because they'd gotten my spiraling pain under control. But they wouldn't speak to us, and they sent a nurse to the phone to tell us that they were an inpatient team and that they prescribed opioids, but that they don't manage withdrawal or tapering.
So there really wasn't anyone who saw it as their responsibility to lead you through withdrawal or to give you even a good plan for withdrawal.
That's right. And so eventually, as we got more desperate and I sounded more desperate on the phone, eventually people would say, well, it sounds like you're a problem for addiction services. Why don't you try an addiction clinic? Or one pain management receptionist said, why don't you try a methadone clinic? And I didn't know any better at the time. So I took that advice and I started looking around. But we quickly learned that those folks didn't see me as their problem either, because as they very kindly and patiently told me, you know, we're dealing with people who have been struggling with addiction, for whom it, you know, it's torn apart their life. Many of them need to be on maintenance programs of methadone and Suboxone. We aren't dealing with getting, you know, someone who had surgery tapered off their meds.
So how long did it take for you to get completely off opioids?
So we stuck to that four-week plan because we never found anyone to help, and it got worse and worse. And at the end of it, we actually decided to give up at the very end. I caved, and I said, I can't do it anymore. I'm scared. I hadn't slept in days, and I was violently ill, and I was depressed, and I was thinking about suicide on a daily basis. Mm. And so I eventually told Sadia, I'm done. She supported the decision, and she managed to get a prescription for a lower dose opioid so that we could try to scale up and not go back to as bad a dose as I was on, as high a dose. But I ended up not having to take it. So I got that prescription, and I fully intended on taking it if I couldn't sleep again that night. But that was on about day 28 or 29. My calendar is a little fuzzy, and I was basically just aging out of the worst of the process, and I fell asleep that night without taking any of the pills. So I slept a decent amount. I slept about 6 hours that night. And when I woke up, I was still quite uncomfortable, but it was such a huge relief compared to where I'd been that I knew I could survive it from then on.
What is the difference between dependency and addiction or substance use disorder?
It's a really good question. So let's do dependence and addiction first, and let's actually hold off on the substance use disorder because it even gets a little bit more complicated. But this is a great question that actually occupied me for a couple of years, because when doctors had told me to go to an addiction clinic, I wasn't defensive. I would have been happy to if that's where I belonged, but it just struck me as weird because it never occurred to me that I might be wrestling with addiction. And the reason it hadn't occurred to me is because I had internalized this view that addiction is a largely behavioral problem. It has to do with acting in a way that brings about bad consequences compulsively, seemingly without control, right? That's what characterizes addiction. But dependence is a physiological feature. And here's the real difference. The real difference is everyone who's listening if you take opioids for long enough in high enough doses, you will develop dependence. This is how brains work, right? And that means, what dependence means is that your brains try to reestablish homeostasis. They try to reestablish their normal state with a bunch of opioids on board. So you take those opioids away and you get the opposite of the euphoria you get with opioids. So opioids bring pain relief and euphoria and sedation. You take the opioids away, your brain has been reset, and you go into dysphoria. You go into hyperalgesia or increased sensitivity to pain. You go into a kind of hyperactive mode instead of sedation. Instead of being constipated where like you are on opioids, you have diarrhea and you vomit, right? So it's the opposite. Withdrawal is the opposite of the effects of the drug. That just happens as a matter of biology. That's not happening because you've developed an addiction. So if you're on the drugs, you'll develop dependence. But a very small minority of people actually develops an addiction. And that's the key distinction, because those who develop an addiction will have these behavioral side effects. They will feel compelled to act in a way, even if it brings about negative consequences like jail, like losing a spouse, like losing a job, like burning down your entire life. That's what characterizes an addiction.
And addiction is not the same as substance use disorder?
Well, so substance use disorder is the broad category. Opioid use disorder is specific to opioids. And what's happening now is there's kind of a move to characterize opioid use disorder in different tiers, citing lots of different diagnostic criteria that brings together behavioral elements from addiction and more physiological features from dependence. And so depending on who you're asking, they might have looked at me and said, yes, he's checked positive for opioid use disorder because I've matched all these dependence criteria. But most doctors that I've spoken to said that's not a very helpful diagnosis, because what I needed was much simpler than someone who needs all of the behavioral health elements because they're suffering from addiction.
Lots more questions, but we need to take a quick break here on The Record on WIPR. Travis Reeder is director of the Master of Bioethics degree program and a research scholar at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about his new book, In Pain. When we're back, what responsibility do doctors have to prevent dependency on opioids? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Opioids have been used to relieve pain for hundreds of years. During the Civil War, doctors relied on morphine to treat battlefield injuries. Heroin was once marketed for the relief of menstrual cramps or to calm fussy children. But this class of drugs carries serious risks. Data from the CDC reveals that deaths caused by prescription opioid overdoses quintupled between 1999 and 2017. Travis Reeder is with us. We're talking about his new book, In Pain, A Bioethicist's Personal Struggle with Opioids. Reeder is a research scholar at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and director of the Master of Bioethics degree program there. How popular are opioids? How widely are they prescribed?
Well, it's changing now, but for a good while, they were incredibly popular. And so starting in about the 1990s, we entered what is sometimes referred to as the decade of pain. And that's loosely from the late 90s, about 1999, to around 2010. And so in that space, just over a decade, prescribing quadrupled. It went up by 400% in the U.S. So they were very, very popular. And a big reason for that is they started to be seen as acceptable prescriptions for moderate to severe pain rather than just severe pain, and for chronic as well as acute pain, even when that pain's outside of the realm of cancer for which it had been a little bit longer established. So all of a sudden, it's seen as acceptable to prescribe for all sorts of moderate to severe, acute and chronic pain. And there's this pain advocacy movement that's coming along at the same time that says, moreover, it's the doctor's responsibility to treat pain, because failure to treat pain constitutes torture by omission. That's the kind of language that's being used here. So it became very popular, but the tide has started to turn because of fear from the opioid crisis.
Why are opioids so addictive?
It's a really good question. A few different things happen with opioids. You know, humans, depending on which specialist you ask, humans can become addicted to a lot of different things, not just drugs, but, you know, gambling or sex or maybe even food. But drugs get characterized as more or less addictive depending on lots of different features. So one is kind of how intense is the high. So in the case of opioids, how intense is the dopamine rush that you get after the opioid, snicks into the brain receptor that it's fitting into. And the answer with opioids is really quite intense. Another question is, how immediate is the euphoria or the pain relief or whatever it is you're getting from drugs from the behavior, say taking a pill? Well, it's pretty immediate, kind of no matter how you ingest. But one of the things that has made opioids more dangerous and addictive is that we've developed to injecting them. So before we had hypodermic needles, you had to rub morphine on your gums or eat it. It was less addictive. Once we developed the hypodermic syringe, you inject it directly into your veins. It's a much more immediate effect on your brain, even more addictive. So you have this really powerful drug that hits really fast, really strongly. It's a recipe for addiction.
Besides the risk of addiction, what are some of the other downsides of opioids as a method of pain relief?
There are a lot, it turns out, and we're only just learning this, which is a little sad. The dependence that I talk about that is distinct from addiction is itself a real risk. And one of the reasons is that dependence can drive addiction. So I think one of the cautionary tales of my story is that if you allow a patient to become dependent just as a matter of routine, well, fear of withdrawal is a really good reason to keep taking a drug. And relieving yourself of withdrawal by taking the drug is a powerful reward. So now you're not only getting euphoria or pain relief, you're also rescuing yourself from withdrawal, right? So dependence can be a powerful driver of addiction. It's not always going to be that case. You know, a lot of people can become dependent without becoming addicted, but it's one way. But it's also just bad in itself. The withdrawal is harmful, as I try to make very clear. And the drugs themselves start to lose their effect. This is just kind of a well-known principle of pharmacology. And so you have to take more to get the same effect. The kind of window of dose responsiveness gets smaller and smaller. And now we're even learning that to a larger, much larger extent than we would have expected several years ago, taking opioids might actually make your pain worse. So you take them long enough and you have something called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which is to say that you actually have increased sensitivity to pain as a result of your pain management plan.
That's Travis Reeder, a bioethicist and research scholar at Johns Hopkins, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, In Pain. You were a patient at three hospitals, well-regarded hospitals, and you had multiple surgeons and doctors. How did you fall through the cracks?
And the answer that I've come to is that it's not useful to blame those individual doctors by the standards of their fields. They did their job. And as a matter of fact, they were really accomplished doctors. I mean, they saved my foot, and I told you how mangled it was. The problem is systemic. The problem is not with individuals, it's with structures. And in this case, the problem is that we're bad at pain anyway. The medical system, so we, the capital we, we're bad at pain anyway. Doctors don't train in pain medicine very well. They don't understand opioids very well. They also, opioids are also stigmatized because of their connection to addiction and the opioid crisis. And so physicians who are not addiction medicine docs don't really want to touch complicated opioid patients. And add to all of that a bunch of other factors, like hospitals are deeply fractured just as it is. You have handoffs between care teams. You have miscommunications. I had 12 prescribers or something like this over the course of three hospitals. Whose job was it? Nobody stood up and said, oh, by the way, he's mine, right? This is just a complex system with no rule set in place.
So how could the United States turn things around?
Well, so specifically regarding the prescription problem, I think it's going to have to be a lot of education. Right now, medical schools don't emphasize pain medication. The rules for CMEs or continuing medical education differ state to state. So we could try to establish something where we say, look, you have a DEA license. You're allowed to prescribe these medications that have these risks. You have to know something about them, right? And that actually doesn't happen, right? You get your DEA license and you don't have to know anything about pain medicine. Now, contrast that with, say, buprenorphine, which we're using for addiction medicine. Buprenorphine is an opioid. It's used to treat opioid use disorder. And there's a certain waiver that you have to get in order to prescribe buprenorphine. It's called the X waiver. And it takes 8 hours for a physician to get the CME to get that waiver. So why we think that it takes some education to use buprenorphine appropriately, acknowledging that it's a complex medicine, but that it doesn't take any education to prescribe oxycodone, that is beyond me.
Was writing this book a healing experience for you?
That's such a great question. It really was. And a lot of people ask it the other way. They ask me if it was traumatizing. And no, it wasn't traumatizing. And I think it was fairly cathartic. It felt great to get it out. And it feels really good for it to be out of me and on the pages and this physical thing in the world that I can point to.
Congratulations and good luck with it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Travis Reeder is director of the Master of Bioethics degree program and a research scholar at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He'll be speaking about his book, In Pain, on Tuesday, July 9th at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road. We've got details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Be with us again on the record tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.